I grew up in Clontarf, and I began working in radio Dublin in 1978. I was there for a few months, and there was a split, and we went to Big D Radio in Chapel Lane, and it was the first 24-hour radio station. We also had FM stereo, one of the first to do that. And I think
in 1978,
in 1978,
it was very early for FM stereo.
It might have been time we got the stereo, because I was with them up until 1981 or 82. We moved premises on a number of occasions. We started in Chapel Lane, and there was a fire. And after the fire, we moved up to Stephen's Green for a short period. There was a lease there, and for a year. Now, all the time, we were under threat of being raided. We had been raided in Chapel Lane. It was a very big raid. They wrecked the place. There were plainclothes policemen, and I think there were plainclothes people. I think some of them might have been from the Post and Telegraphs, and there were also uniformed Gardaí as well.
Were you there? Were you in the building?
I wasn't
at the time?
In the building. No, I was the next day when I came in, because I kind of worked full time in radio at the time. I was, besides being on air, I was doing all sorts of other administrative duties as well. So the raid, the place was completely wrecked, but we got back on the air. We went to court and all of that, and we kind of won some sort of an injunction. We took an injunction against the government to cease raiding and so on. And we got our equipment back and so on. I think we paid some fine at the time. We trundled along. We went to Stephen's Green after the fire. We were there for a while, and that was a kind of a strange place, strange building. It was a four-story building on St. Stephen's Green. It had a club in the basement. It had, I think it was a gay club in the basement. We were on the top. We had the top two floors, and we had offices on the third floor, and fourth floor was the radio station. We were there for a while, and then RTE 2FM came about, and I think that was sometime in 79. And we lost a good number of staff, went from us, Dave Fanning, Marty Whelan, and others, you know.
Currently still has some names.
A lot of them still, of course. So the rest of us were left behind, were a little bit disappointed. We didn't get the gig as it was at the time. But we trundled along when we moved out of Stephen's Green and went to Camden Street, the old Deluxe Cinema in Camden Street. Had a few years there with small bunker in the cinema. So great fun, because we had lots of live broadcasts and so on, linking up with the Olympic Ballroom, broadcasting Madness Live was one that I remember, and lots of fun and lots of experimentation. And the station had a sort of a policy where it was, during the daytime hours, it was sort of popular music, and somewhere along 7 o'clock in the evening, around about then, it turned into more rock and roll or rock or whatever it was. But it was a different type of album tracks, and a little bit, it wouldn't have been your popular music. And it had, therefore it had a dual personality and a dual audience. So it was known by different people for different reasons.
What kind of power were you putting out at this stage on AM, do you know, for instance?
On AM, I think it was... I was never very good on the technical. It was a home built rig. I think it was so many watts. I don't know. But it was powerful enough. The are you talking about the AM rig now?
Well, both the AM and FM. I mean, how far were you getting? Were you covering most of the city, for instance?
Yes, we would cover the city. Yeah, we absolutely covered the city. Now our FM signal was. It mightn't have been as strong. It mightn't have covered the entire city, and that might have been because of the transmission site, more than likely because of the transmission site. We were covering the city. We had quite a powerful signal, certainly on AM, and a decent signal on FM.
And you mentioned the variety of programmes. So was it mostly, do you think, a community-focused station, or was it more commercial, or was it a mixture of both?
It was definitely a mixture of both, because I produced a number of programmes on Big D. One was called Tá an Aimtear Go Hálainn, which was on a Saturday afternoon. And that one got people from the community, particularly more at the time for us, more elderly people, all people older than us, to relate their stories of life and how they worked, how they lived. And
was it in Irish, this programme, or just the title?
The title, and it was a little bit bilingual. Okay. A little bit bilingual. We were playing with the idea of introducing some Irish into the programming. Tony Allen, who also worked with us on Big D Radio, had a program called You Don't Have to Be Gay, which was really, at the time, a little bit out there. It would have been very avant-garde at the time.
Extremely avant-garde, thinking of the late 70s in Ireland.
That's right.
It was a very innovative thing to do.
It was, because it was still illegal. It was a criminal offence to have homosexual relationships at the time.
Would be for another 15 years or so.
And all of that was going on as a backdrop, I suppose, in terms of cultural change in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So I think in many ways what the pirate radios did, just not just Big D Radio, but all of them, is they contributed hugely to the cultural changes in Ireland that we see today as something that broke the mould. And I think that's really important to know.
And another station, of course, that's credited with breaking the mould so comprehensively is Radio Nova.
Yes.
Chris Carey's Radio Nova, and you were involved in that as well. So
can you
tell us about your involvement in that?
After a period, I went to work there doing a programme on a Sunday evening, and it was, again, a rock programme, so I was probably the first guy to do rock music on Radio Nova. Radio Nova was brilliant. I mean, it had processing equipment. It was professional from the beginning. It was professional in the sense that the presenters who worked on it were very professional. The equipment, the studios, the pay, your pay related social insurance, your bonus holiday stuff, the promotions, all of that was very professional. We very quickly grew a large audience, and the program I presented. I initially produced it for Tony Allen. Tony Allen and myself worked very closely together over the years, and I produced a number of programs for him. And this, the one I did on Nova for him initially was called Stick It In Your Ear. And it was a four-hour rock and roll program with interviews with Dublin bands, demo tapes, and the latest music of the time. Now, Tony was apt to sort of migrating, and he moved, I think, to Cork on one occasion. And I turned up to produce the program, everything ready, but he wasn't there. So I ended up going on air to cover the time. So that was fine, and that was how I really began it. Chris Carey came rushing into the studio. He was around in the Henry Grattan, and he didn't know what was going on. He didn't know who was on air, and he came in and had some words. But he was happy enough, and I did that for a few more weeks, and then he asked me to move across to Kiss FM. So I started working on Kiss FM, doing the same type of program, only now I was doing it five nights a week for the initial period, and then I moved back to three nights, and Greg Cochran did two and I did three. So I did that for a number of years, up until around about, 1983. I think it was September, October 83.
So you would have been in Nova then when the raids took place?
I was, yeah.
Can you tell us about your memories of that?
Yes, I came to the studio the morning the raid had taken place, and I came in, I suppose, about 11 o'clock, and the place was only in disarray in that people were in disarray. Everyone was there, everybody was shocked. RTE were coming in to interview. So I didn't experience what actually happened in terms of, remember now, the transmission equipment would have been up at Three Rock. So there was only a microwave link to the transmission site. So all of the activity would have happened up on the mountain. The day was strange because we managed, and my memory of it was that we managed to get a small rig on, and we went back on air, and we got people to come along at 6 o'clock to Herbert Street. Herbert Street was packed, and as far as I know, it went around the corner onto Baggot Street, and it looked like there were certainly hundreds, if not more than 1,000 or a couple of thousand people. I'm not sure, but a lot of people. The place was packed. Outside, cheering us on and waiting for 6 o'clock, when Tony Allen asked everyone to blow their car horn, which, as far as I understand, nearly everyone in the city, or most people in the city, did. Yeah, a lot of people did. Yeah, sure. So it was a very exciting radio station. Yes. What was good about that was it introduced formatting. That was good and bad. It was good in that it lent a professionalism to it, and it gave it structure. And within the structure, now you were allowed a certain amount of movement within the structure, which I think is better than being totally tied down by formatting. So, and I was lucky enough in that I wasn't formatted. I was allowed to do what I did because, I don't know, yeah, I just was allowed to do what I did.
And do you have any particular anecdotes or any particular stories that you remember about individuals or people that you worked with during those years in Nova? Lots of big names involved, and of course a very renowned station owner as well, Chris Carey.
Yeah, well, Chris himself, I had a great working relationship with Chris. Of course, I had everybody, that's the thing about Nova, everybody was very friendly. We were a team. It was interesting, like Declan, John Clark, Bob Gallico, and I know I'm probably leaving out lots of people, but they were a very close team. And Kerry sort of, I don't know how it was, but Kerry, yeah, I'll tell you a story. I went down to the Henry Grattan, as we were apt to do after a programme and meet up, and we were having a few pints, and Chris was there with Remy, his wife at the time. And he was wondering whether he'd bring in Mike Malone to do a breakfast programme. Mike Maloney, Mike Moran. And he said, well, look, if it doesn't work out, I'll go on the air myself. And I said to him, I don't think that would be a good idea, Chris. I don't think you would work. You know, something like, I don't know if I said you're past it or something stupid, you know. But he immediately got up out of his seat. This was in the Henry Grattan. And there was a gang of Nova staff around having a pint, left. I thought that was the end of it. He drove up to Nova Park up in Rathfarnham and fired everybody, right? And
the entire station,
the entire anybody who was working in Nova Park was fired. And he a phone call came back to Herbert Street, where I was now. I was back in Herbert Street, and saying, Dennis, you better watch out. Gary's after firing everybody. What did you do? So I explained what I did. So I was on tenterhooks after that. The next day, I came into the station again, as I would normally do, and I met Chris in the hallway in 19 Herbert Street, and he walked towards me, and I thought, oh God, I'm going to get it now. I'm going to be fired or whatever. And he said, stay out of my way for the next while. So I wasn't fired, but just
marginalized
for a little while. So I thought I kind of just got by. You know, I didn't get fired. I really liked Chris. One of the things that that there is a lot of talk about now is nominating Chris Carey for the IMRO Hall of Fame, Radio Hall of Fame. I mean, his contribution to radio, you know, is second to none in terms of how he took what had already begun in the smaller pirates, which of course were very innovative and creative in themselves and groundbreaking, but he took it to a next stage, and that really needs to be recorded and marked.
And did you know at the time, did you have a sense that you were involved in something great, or was it just a job to you, or was there really a sense of excitement working in Herbert Street or in later iterations of the station?
No words could explain how exciting it was. No words could explain how we felt that this would actually make us, and we felt, well, I certainly didn't, I presume my colleagues as well, felt like you were walking on air. It was almost like a dream. You couldn't be doing a better job. We loved doing what we did. We felt we were groundbreaking, and we had people behind us. We had audiences. We had audiences who loved what we did. So, and we were working at what we liked doing. So yes, there was a huge sense of excitement. Now, there were different levels of excitement. There was excitement in the early days in terms of, you know, we're breaking the law and we may, you know, what's going to happen and all of that. But we were so young, we were kind of like, our attitude was, well, feck them, you know. We'll do this anyway because it should be done. So there was that kind of thing in every one of us. We all wanted to do this because it wasn't there before. And we had to import popular radio into the country. It wasn't happening in RTÉ or anywhere else. So we listened to Radio Luxembourg before that, and to be able to provide it and to see that an audience loved it was really a great thing.
And you were involved, there were several stations called Kiss FM, and you were involved in two of them.
Yeah.
The first one, Chris Carey's Kiss FM, the second one, the highly successful Kiss FM in Monaghan, that was only on the air in 1988. So that was an enormously important station, broadcasting across the border, beaming into Belfast and so on. Tell us about your involvement in that and your memories of that time.
Yeah, it was a very powerful station in terms of the megawatts, the 1.5 megawatts being beamed into Northern Ireland. And again, I'm not a technical person, but it was a very powerful station in the sense of its transmission. It was also hugely important, I think, in colleagues of mine would say it was hugely important in sort of bringing something to Northern Ireland that wasn't there before. And even some people would go so far as to say that it may even have helped the peace process. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous, but like people do say these things, right? It certainly would have, there would have been Southern accents broadcasting into Belfast, and there were Northern accents and English accents as well. But it was very short-lived. It began in April and closed on 31st of December of that year, 1988. I was broadcasting for almost 5 hours before, from 2 o'clock until half five, I think it was, or maybe even earlier, 12 till half five. And then Tom Hardy closed it down at between half five and six. That was a very interesting station. I only worked on it on weekends. I drove up from Dublin to Monaghan. We broadcast out of Monaghan town, and I broadcast on Saturdays in the afternoon. So I would just catch up with my colleagues on the weekend there. I think its importance was how we managed to broadcast out of the south of Ireland. Not wanting to differentiate, but from the Republic to Northern Ireland.
And what were your feelings then on that night on the 31st of December 1988? Or was it the 30th that you closed? Some stations closed a day early.
I think I can't remember which one of them it was. I think I'm not sure.
It doesn't matter now, but regardless of the date, the 30th or the 31st, how did you feel at the time?
I suppose we felt in a sense that, personally I felt, yes, it was terrible, but I thought that it actually had come to a place where we were going to be able to apply. I mean, the stations as they stood would be able to apply. And they were able to apply laterally. However, not all of them got licences or they fell apart in the interim, because there was a very long time between the close down and the awarding of licences. And the first licence was for Century, I think it was Century Radio was the first one.
Capital Radio Dublin, July in 1999.
Yeah, Capital Radio, and then Century, I think, was second, yeah. What happened was, again, like any of these things, when people split up, and I suppose it's not that loyalties disappear, because it's not about that. It's about moving forward and ensuring you're part of whatever's happening. And some people went to Capital and some people went to the various stations. I ended up working in 98 FM, as it happened, and put some applications together for the IRTC during 1989. Right. That's right, yeah. So, my feeling at the time of its closing down, I actually thought we were going to have, that nothing would change too much. That's what I thought. What I didn't realise was that when it became more properly structured business-wise and legally, the fun would disappear a little bit, because when something becomes solely a business, the business took over from a little bit from the art, and that's a pity, because you need both. Yeah. Now that's coming back again, I think. I'm delighted. I had the opportunity to work in it and be in it from its earliest stages till the end. I know they came back a little bit after that. I'm delighted to have been part of that. I look back on it fondly and think that there was a great contribution made from Pirate Radio to the Irish popular cultural scene, and that's its legacy. It has certainly helped change a lot of things in Ireland. If you look at the period, and that period I'm talking about, the late 70s through the decade, 78, 88, that decade, if you look at what was happening in terms of popular music, bands like the Radiators, U2, so on, all these bands, and a move away from ballrooms, I suppose, and a move away from the mores, the sexual mores that existed before that. So there was a lot of change, what I call popular cultural change, and I think that there was a huge contribution made there.